Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the 2:30 docket for the Texas Third Court of Appeals. Before us, we have, this is cause number 031927CR. Blair Beck McCall versus the state of Texas. And this is on rehearing, is that right? That's a curious one. We don't get to do that a whole lot. So before we get started, let's talk about what we're gonna do today, and then I'll ask for announcements from the lawyers in this case. We're gonna have oral argument. Each side is going to be limited to 20 minutes. Mr. McCall, I'm assuming that you are reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, because I'm looking at the time clock there and it says 15. So for both you and for attorney for the state, when y'all get to 2 minutes left in your argument, the yellow light will come on. When you are out of time for that section, then the red light will come on. If you proceed beyond that, then you could be eating into your rebuttal time, if that's applicable to you. When the red light comes on, please wrap up answering any question or finishing any comment that you were just making, and don't proceed further without further asking leave of court. And let's see what else. This case is being broadcast on YouTube, both audio and visual. When we're concluded at the end of the day, the audio file will be available on the court's website for consideration. And I think that's it. With that, let's get started. This is cause number 031927CR, Blair Beck McCall versus the state of Texas. And for the appellant, Mr. McCall.
I'm David McCall with the firm of Gray Becker PC here in Austin, Texas.
And, thank you, sir.
Ready to proceed.
And for the state of Texas?
My name is Wes Mao. I am the criminal district attorney for Hays County, Texas. I'll be representing the state today.
Very good. Thank you. And Mr. McCall, whenever you're ready.
All right. Justice Goodwin, Justice Kelly, Justice Baker, thank you for giving us an opportunity to appear before you today. I agree with Justice Goodwin. I think this is an unusual situation. Certainly not one I've encountered before. As I understand our role here today, or what we've been asked to do, other than file supplemental briefings, which the state and we had filed, is to give you our thoughts and comments on how the court should proceed in light of the March 10th, 2021 decision in Ortiz versus State. And that's what I'm prepared to do. If there are any other questions about issues raised in my motion for rehearing, other than that, please feel free to ask about those. But I'm not here directly to argue the motion for rehearing, because I think, assuming Ortiz stands, that case is dispositive of the issues raised in my motion for rehearing. So I'm going to concentrate on Ortiz today and tell you what I think. As we all are aware, Ortiz Court, the criminal appeals, and I'll call them CCA from this point forward, held that in a case where the state elects to choose and proceed with an occlusion injury charge, strangulation charge, that any other non-impeding injury that's caused during the commission of that or non-commission of that offense is not a lesser included offense for purposes of submission of a lesser included offense to a jury. And in fact, the Court of Criminal Appeals, the CCA, held that, in effect, that occlusion is the unit of prosecution, not it's its own form of bodily injury. It's different than bodily injury caused by general assault. And I understand there are motions for rehearing filed in the case. And so So I won't address those either, but I can tell you where I think we are right now based on that jury finding, on the Ortiz finding in March 10th, is the charge that was submitted in appellant's case, the lesser included charge under Ortiz, is not a lesser included charge because it involves an injury other than occlusion. In this case, I think it might be a bump on the head or it might not something like that, but it's not a lesser included offense. And the court in Ortiz gives several examples of things that are no longer considered to be lesser included offenses for non-impeded injuries. For example, if somebody's neck is sore from pressure being applied to it, somebody gets a bump on their head or gets hit in the face, those are all distinct, separate assaultive crimes, but they're not lesser included crimes of occlusion assault. So what happens when an assault is submitted to the jury, or a lesser included charge is submitted to the jury, that's actually not a lesser included offense of the greater offense that was charged? It's my understanding that the submission of a charge like that would constitute jury error. And egregious jury error. And the cases that I've looked at it, and I've cited in my brief, supplemental briefing, all require that in that instance where the charge is submitted in that manner, and it's not a lesser included charge, that the case should be reversed. And that's what, if Ortiz stands, that's what this court should do after the harm analysis finding that the charge was submitted in error.
Mr. McCall, then let's say, hypothetically, we agree with you on what you've just said about simple bodily assault as a lesser. Do we stop at Ortiz or do we overturn the conviction, or do we have to do something more after we go through that analysis? Is there something left to do in your view?
Well, and you're assuming that Ortiz is not changed on rehearing.
Right, assuming that it stands, right.
Assuming that it stands, I think from my analysis of the law is that there's one or two things that have to happen after the court reverses. And that is, I think the court is required to do two things. I think it's required to do a harm analysis. And I think the outcome of that in every case I've seen is a reversal. And then I think it needs to do a legal sufficiency analysis again in light of the Ortiz holding of the evidence that was submitted that was previously found to support the underlying lesser included conviction that we now know, if Ortiz stands, is not a lesser included offense. And the reason I think the court goes to that analysis is that, and it's kind of interesting in the case that I've read and studied somewhat at length, what I'll call the Benavides case, and I've cited it in my brief, where there's kind of a struggle between what to do with a case like this once it's reversed. Do you send it back to the trial court and tell them to take care of it, or can the Court of Appeals reverse the case itself? And my understanding is that that's that decision, which way it goes, is undertaken by a legal sufficiency analysis of the evidence that was submitted to support the underlying conviction. Now, one of the consequences, I mean, if the court finds that the non-included lesser offense was not supported by legally sufficient information, then I think the court has the authority, this court has the authority to enter a judgment of acquittal under Benavides if the court finds that the evidence is sufficient to support the underlying conviction. Then it would remand the case to the trial court to do whatever the trial court wants to do with it. Now, it's kind of interesting. I noticed in the state prosecuting attorney's office in Benny Vitti's case, they're going to go remand it to do what? Because as in this case, appellant has already been acquitted of the greater charge and the state can't proceed the indictment or to prosecute him on a lesser charge because it's not within the scope of the indictment.
Right, but would you agree then that the state could prosecute a different offense that wasn't alleged, a different assault that wasn't alleged in the original indictment?
It's our position, Justice Kelly, that it could not. That remember, this event took place almost 6 years ago, and the statute of limitations for any misdemeanor is 2 years. And we've cited Marks versus State in our case or brief that we believe would preclude a subsequent indictment or amendment of the indictment to include another charge because it's not the same conduct, act, or transaction.
And I know in your brief, Mr. McCall, you've argued that in your sufficiency analysis, but those are all issues for the would you agree that those are all issues for the trial court and not for the appellate court, whether or not the statute of limitations have run on other offenses?
I'm not sure about that, Justice Kelly. I know that, for example, in our brief, if the effect of a conviction for a not and lesser included offense renders that conviction unsupported by sufficient evidence, which would give this court the authority to enter a judgment of acquittal on the underlying charge without remanding it back to the trial court.
But if we've held that it's not, if we follow your argument and if we agree with you that Ortiz says this can't be a lesser included offense, then we haven't, I mean, that's just dealing with the original charge. How does that in any way affect, you know, these other charges didn't exist. We're not doing anything to these other charges because we've already held that they're not lesser included. So,
well, Justice Kelly, I don't know of no other offenses that is your hypothetical, could the state go back and re-indict appellant for misdemeanor family violence?
Could they? Or, you know,
another offense.
Say hypothetically, for the concussive event, whatever that was.
For the what? I'm sorry?
For the whatever the event was that allegedly caused a concussion, something like that.
Again, we don't believe that. That the trial court could do that based on the length of time and existing case law. And of course, that would be another issue.
But I think Judge Kelly's question was statute of limitations. Is that something that this court decides, or is that more of a defensive issue that should go back and should be resolved by the trial court?
Well, my thought would be that, that if this court determines that the legal sufficiency is the lesser included is not supported by legal sufficient evidence, it has authority to reverse and render acquittal on this charge. And if the state believes that it can go to a grand jury and get another charge against appellant, then I don't know how we could stop it, but I don't think legally they can do that.
Let me shift back to Ortiz. Ortiz talks about some limitations. Why do those limitations not apply? Why do you believe those limitations don't apply in your case?
I'm not aware. I think our case is indistinguishable from Ortiz, and I'm not aware of any limitations that Ortiz puts on non-impeding injuries. It just says that if it's a non-impeding injury, it's not a lesser included. charge.
It says that, well, but it does talk about there are some scenarios where a lesser included could be submitted to the jury.
Well, yes, and I see what you're saying now. It's
i.e. dating, where dating relationship is at issue.
A dating relationship in a proper case. I believe it mentions an attempted occlusion could be a lesser included, depending on the facts of this case, of that case. But I don't think that that's an issue in this case. But it's I noticed that I took a look at the briefs that were submitted on the motion for rehearing by the Ortiz people, the attorneys. And they mentioned Beck versus Alabama, which they attempt to say that the Ortiz opinion would foreclose the submission of all lesser included charges. But I think the Court of Criminal Appeals takes care to state that, no, we're not precluding the application of lesser included charges in proper circumstances.
But going to what Justice Goodwin says, do you believe Ortiz says just in attempt, and when the issue of the familial relationship is at issue, those are the only times when you could get a lesser included?
Those are the two it mentions, and I can't think of any others right offhand where that might be a lesser included. Another unrelated offense might be a lesser included. I think that's where we are with Ortiz, and I'll be glad to answer any further questions you have about it. I think I'm not used to seeing that little timer up there in the corner, but looks like I'm running out of time.
And it has its own square. It makes it very, it kind of bumps it up in its level of importance. We'll give you the 50 seconds back on rebuttal if you need it. How's that sound?
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Mao, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. I like Mr. McCall, understood the court had granted oral argument in this case to essentially discuss the effect of Ortiz on the appellant's motion for rehearing and, of course, the ultimate outcome of this appeal. So, obviously, I don't want to spend a lot of time belaboring the points that were made either in our original briefs or the court's original opinion in this case, although I do want to say that I think the court's original opinion in this case does set out a lot of the dispositive case law on a number of the issues that I think are in play in Ortiz. The first thing that I do want to point out is we attempted in our brief to make a distinction between the facts of this case and the facts that are presented in the Ortiz cases. Although I have to say that the court's opinion, the majority opinion in Ortiz, is very vague about what facts were alleged to have constituted the lesser included offense. In other words, was it a situation where some of the other acts, the punching and other sorts of things that are not associated with the occlusion injury at all, were submitted as the lesser included offense, lesser included assault with bodily injury, or not? In our case, it clearly was. In our case, the lesser included offense that was submitted was, I think, absolutely and unequivocally the exact same offense, the exact same incident, the exact same act that we were alleging caused the impediment to breath or blood, only absent the element of the impediment, the impeding of the breath or the blood. We weren't alleging, in other words, that if the jury did not believe that the defendant strangled the victim, that if they thought he merely punched her in the head, that that would suffice. We were essentially alleging, if you believe that the defendant did something to impede the breath of the blood, and it did not impede the breath of the blood, but caused some other injury, that same act, then that would be the lesser included offense.
And Mr. Mao, going down that road, you know, I'm sure you agree under two-step lesser included analysis for a lesser. Under step one, we can't look to the evidence, only the statute and what's been charged with any descriptive averments. What, if anything, And I think you've just answered my question, though. But what if anything in this indictment modifies the relevant statutory elements of occlusion assault? Or does it just track the statute?
It just tracks the statute. And here's where I think the Ortiz case becomes confusing on that point, is the Ortiz case in an assault by impeding breath or blood allegation, what the state has to prove is that first, there was an assault bodily injury. There has to be an assault with bodily injury. Bodily injury is defined in the statute as physical pain, illness, or impairment of physical condition. So we have to prove that. If in addition to that, we prove that the victim was, I'll say a family member, just to avoid the lengthy definition of the relationship. If we prove that the victim was a family member, and in addition to that, we prove that it was, that the injury that constitutes the bodily injury was caused by impeding the breath of the blood, then that makes the case a felony instead of a misdemeanor. What seems to get confusing there is that the Ortiz case refers to occlusion injuries as a separate and distinct kind of injury from the sorts of injuries that would constitute assault bodily injury, but it simply can't be, because you have to prove an assault with bodily injury first in order to even get to the stage of considering whether or not that injury was caused by impeding breath or blood.
Well, I think, and Mr. Mao, that was Judge Yeary's point in his concurrence and dissent, right? Exactly that point. I guess my question is, even if we believe that reading, what can we as an appellate court do with Ortiz? Because if there are no descriptive averments, as you've just said, and we compare the statute to the offense under step one, under Ortiz says it's not a lesser included. If there's some other portion of that opinion that you can point us to that says says something else, but whether or not, you know, we academically agree or disagree about the separate writings in the case, we have a majority opinion that we, as the Third Court of Appeals, are bound by. So where do we go from here?
That's the struggle, I think, Your Honor. is to draw that distinction, and the reason I think it is a viable course for this court to make that distinction is because it is so unclear whether the Ortiz majority, what exactly they were talking about. Now the distinction is whether they were speaking when they say that all assault bodily injury cases are not lesser included of an occlusion injury. When they say that, is that dicta? Because that's not really what they were talking about. That's not really the facts of the case they were dealing with, or is it not? Now it was clearly intended by the court to be, if it is dicta, it was clearly intended to be, I'm trying to remember the phrase, conclusive at least in terms of how a later court should view those types of situations.
So then what's the distinction that we can make then? If that's dicta, then we go to what?
Yeah, the distinction I would make is that one of the differences between Judge Yeary's dissent and Judge Keller's dissent is this idea of whether or not, when there are multiple injurious acts that occur over the course of a single transaction, is that one assault or multiple assaults? If it's one assault, then Ortiz really makes little sense, because you're saying that by alleging that one of the assaultive acts caused impediment of breath or blood, none of the other ones even count. And that's, of course, Judge Keller's point. If it's a single act, as Judge Yeary discusses, then the question is, if we are talking about the same act as opposed to a different act, in other words, we're talking about the hand or arms on the throat as opposed to the punch to the head, then that's not what Ortiz was dealing with. Ortiz was dealing with different acts.
But those are all
the same act.
But Mr. Mao, those are all facts raised by the evidence, or evidence that's been raised in step two of the lesser included analysis, right?
Correct.
How do we even get to step two? I mean, we didn't get through step one with comparing it, the statute with the indictment and the averments and the indictments.
And that's where I'm saying the difficulty there is, because Ortiz does not tell us what the charge said or what the facts that justified the charge specifically were. We can't know. I am willing to concede that Judge Keel, in that majority opinion, did not intend to draw that distinction. I do not believe that Judge Keel, if we were to ask her, would say that that's a distinction that she intended to leave open for the state, which is why I say that's the struggle here, is to make that distinction. I do think you have to.
So down the road,
what beyond her word.
So down the road, what does that mean to the punching and injury to the head? Does that mean that you could, if assuming you're within the statute of limitations, that you could charge that?
It means a variety of things, all of which are extremely troubling for our prior criminal jurisprudence. Pretty much everything that's in the original opinion that this court issued in this case is essentially in danger of, if not directly overturned by what Ortiz says, if we take Ortiz at face value. But some of the major consequences are, if the, for example, the punch to the head or the squeezing of the throat causing pain, if that is a separate crime from the squeezing of the throat and causing impediment to breathing, a separate crime that cannot be considered as a lesser included offense, then those are two crimes that have to be prosecuted separately in separate courts, in separate trials, before separate judges, before separate juries. The exact same thing that we presented to this jury in our lesser included charge would presumably be presented to a misdemeanor court before a six-person jury on exactly the same facts, exactly the same testimony, and presumptively give us the exact same result, which was, you know, part of what y'all decided in your original opinion, because you determined that the evidence was sufficient to prove those allegations in that lesser included charge. The problem with that, of course, is that if you just look at the statutes, as the Blockberger test asks you to do, there's no additional elements to the injury offense as there is to the occlusion offense. So Blockberger would say prosecuting that defendant twice, or prosecuting him, whether it's at the same time or subsequently, he can't be punished twice. He can't be prosecuted twice, because those are the same offense. So
the jeopardy implications are troubling to me. They
right.
Are.
So frankly, the Ortiz case essentially says that this Blockberger barred prosecution is what the state has to do if the state wants to get even the option of having a misdemeanor conviction in a case where occlusion may be justified by the evidence, but not necessarily conclusively justified by the evidence, which is what we were dealing with in this case. And that's
go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. So that's the double jeopardy problem. Justice Keller, or Judge Keller, in her dissent also, I think, raises an additional issue that, which is not necessarily implicated in our case, but which I think is important. The Ortiz case concedes that if you allege a family member victim with a prior conviction for a family member offense, then that would be a lesser included offense. So what if you allege both? What if I say, in this case, there was an occlusion offense committed against a family member and this defendant's been previously convicted before, and now we can't present the lesser included offense on the lesser included because we don't have the occlusion? Or do we get the lesser included, just like we did here, when the jury determines that there was no prior conviction, but now you have the question of, did they convict of the occlusion type offense, or of some sort of lesser style bodily injury? And that's where I think that Ortiz has gotten confused, because the cases that Ortiz cites for the justification of finding that these are separate injuries do not say what Ortiz says they say. I'll give you two examples of that. Ortiz cites the Marshall case for saying that impeding is a form of bodily injury. What Marshall says is, in other words, obstructing or impeding a person's ability to breathe impairs a person's physical condition, a form of bodily injury. It is the impairment of physical condition that is the bodily injury, not the means by which the physical condition became impaired. Ortiz also cites Price and says that according to Price, impeding is the required injury, but that's taken from the statement in Price that the second set of mental states, the mental states that apply to the occlusion injury as opposed to the original misdemeanor charge, impeding the normal breathing or circulation of the blood of the person describes the required injury. Normal breathing or circulation of the blood has been impeded. What Price actually said was that the required injury for impeding the required injury is that the breathing or circulation has been impeded. They're describing the means by which the injury is caused, not the injury itself. You don't injure, because bodily injury, as I said when I started out, the first thing we have to show is that there was a bodily injury. Impairment of breath or blood is not a bodily injury. Impeding the breath or blood is not a bodily injury. It's the impairment of physical condition that arises from that is the bodily injury.
And Mr. Mao, let me ask you this. If you were to write the court's, if we were to issue an opinion on rehearing where we addressed Ortiz as it is not addressed in our prior opinion, what would be the roadmap for an intermediate appellate court to distinguish that? I mean, you've raised, hey, they cited this case. This case doesn't stand for this proposition, but in our procedural, where we are, what would be your roadmap if you were writing the opinion as to how Ortiz does not change the outcome of our original decision?
If I were to write it, I would have to make the distinction and say, it appears to us that Ortiz was dealing with situations in which the act alleged to have caused the impediment to breath or blood is a different act than what the lesser included bodily injury only misdemeanor is intended to address. And because then, in this case, they are the self-same act, then that's how I would make the distinction. And I can see that is a distinction that I do not think that Judge Keel intended to make.
And then since under step two, you know, we look at the indictment and the statute and the descriptive averments before we go to the facts, how do we get to step two? Is your position, well, you know, now Ortiz has sort of made a mess out of Hall and these other things, and how do we do this two-step analysis, or the two-step analysis has changed because of this particular offense? Because all those things though are fact things. Right. So how would we get to number two, facts?
And this is another thing that I think it's important for the court to think about, is that under Hall, when we're talking about these descriptive averments and how that affects the giving of a lesser included offense, we're talking about the descriptive averments that modify the greater offense, not the lesser offense. The lesser offense is solely, the sole consideration, all the cases that talk about it, is you look just at the statutory elements. So in other words, if I allege that an assault occurred against a person that I describe in some way that is unnecessary to the assault statute, but makes that a felony, and then I do not prove that person was, for example, a pregnant person, but I do prove that person was had some other status that would also make that a lesser included offense, I can use that unnecessary averment for the felony to get the lesser included offense. Let me try to think of a better example.
So you're kind of going to where I want to. Does the objection in this case about the inclusion of the lesser included offense, does it matter in light of Ortiz? The objection that we have in this case, does it matter? Because it's very general. I'm going to object up to the lesser. I think the evidence has been raised, but.
No, it doesn't. I would consider that objection essentially be a non-objection. That's basically saying I'm objecting for form's sake, but I don't really have a reason to give the court. That objection provided no rationale for the trial court to determine that there was any problem. In fact, he basically said, I'm objecting, but I don't think there's a problem. So, you know, the trial court was under no notice as to what argument they were attempting to make as to why the lesser included offense should not be considered.
And I apologize, I keep bringing up step two, but step two, but in this case, since the state requested the lesser, we don't even look at the evidence that's been presented in the trial court, right?
Right. I think the only thing that we would look at in terms of the lesser here, because all of the elements of the lesser included offense are included in the greater offense, it's unnecessary to consider the descriptive averments, because Hall was intended to expand the available lesser included offenses in cases where the greater offense alleges additional facts from which we can infer or read the elements of the lesser included offense. So just because they may not be lesser included looking at the statutes alone, if there are allegations in the greater offense that would bring the lesser included offense into play, you can still, that's what the cognate pleadings is all about. And that's what distinguishes the cognate pleadings test from the statutory test alone, is instead of just looking at the elements, we're gonna look at whatever the other averments were in the indictment to determine that, okay, we can include this lesser included offense in this case because the state did allege facts which would give us all of the elements of the lesser included offense. It was never intended to limit lesser included offenses by looking at those additional factual averments and saying, because they alleged these extra facts here, that they also have to prove those with respect to the lesser included offense. There's never been a case that says that. And that, I think, like I say, again, that's one of the confusions that I think Ortiz runs into, is that it assumes that the element of impeding breath or blood, which is only part of the greater offense, must be proven in the lesser offense when there is no precedent that says that. So because, you know, that these pragmatic consequences in terms of all of these charging decisions, jury charge decisions, the Blockberger problems with double jeopardy, the statute of limitations problems that Mr. McCall raises, all of those go away if we simply go back to looking at lesser included offenses the way we would have before Ortiz, and the way we still would on any other case that isn't an impeding breath or blood case.
Okay, and I hear you on that, but we're stuck with Ortiz, and we've got to try and resign ourselves to how to work within it. Let's say that we find that under Ortiz, that the lesser included was erroneously given. What relief can this intermediate court give in this case?
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I answer?
Yeah, I know. I'm going to give Mr. McCall some extra time too, because.
Okay. Under the Beasley case, which I cited in the brief, any lesser included offense that is not included in the original charge, if that's given and the defendant is convicted on that, then that's essentially convicting somebody on a charge that they were not charged with. That's egregious harm per se. Obviously, the conceptual problem there is what we talked about at the beginning. We've proven all the elements of this case. All the elements were in the indictment. The defendant was convicted on it. So where could the harm be? If it is egregious harm, then the court has to reverse. If the court reverses, then I do think if we refile the case, either in misdemeanor court or in felony court, it's a decision for the trial court at that point as to whether or not that would violate either double jeopardy or statute of limitations or something else. Those are not ripe issues for this court at this time.
So it's not an acquittal. I heard some that we could render and do everything up here.
Well, you would, I think, affirm the acquittal of the greater offense and then simply say that the conviction of the lesser offense is a nullity at this point.
Right. And just send it back to the trial court for whatever happens. I guess there's nothing left to send back, is there?
No, there would be nothing left to send back. We would have to refile some new charging instrument alleging.
Or not. Right.
Or not. But essentially, we would allege this. If we were, we would allege the same facts that are in this charging instrument and proceed on those same facts to a trial to presumably the same result. So now I am. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything else from Justices Kelly or Baker? All right, Mr. McCall.
Mr. McCall, you're on mute.
Okay. I agree with Mr. Mao with regard to your question about the general objection. His conclusion that regardless of whether or not the objection was made, the submission of a non-lesser included charge is a constitutional kind of error. It's a due process error, and it's egregious error. So I agree that one of the few things we agree on is that this case would have to be reversed. And I agree with you that I think this court is, as you say, stuck with Ortiz. I'm not sure what that means. I mean, it's an interesting opinion. I think it's correct. It's a position that we've taken all along since even our motion for new trial in the trial court. But with regard to Mr. Mao's assertion that as long as a lesser included is conducted by the same ways and means of statutory inclusion, that's a lesser included offense, that issue is addressed in Ortiz, in which they say that strangulation without impeding is a crime without a gravamen. Any injury to the neck that's not caused by occlusion is not a lesser included offense of occlusion. So I don't know the justices like Mr. Mao does, but to me, the language in Ortiz is straightforward, it's simple, it draws a bright line test. It keeps us from having to argue about, as we have done with Mr. Mao, about whether there's such a thing as felony strangulation or such a thing as misdemeanor strangulation.
Mr. McCall, what's your response to Mr. Mao's points about, if we read Ortiz as you're asking us to read Ortiz, then it creates this sort of, I don't know, black hole for lesser included, assaults that are not full strangulations. Mr. McCall, did we lose you? Sorry. That may have been my computer. Create statute of limitation problems, double jeopardy problems, and that could not have been what the Court of Criminal Appeals intended when they wrote Ortiz, so we shouldn't read it to reach that result.
Well, my response to that is, after some 47 years of practice, I've seen a lot of courts issue opinions that upend a lot of things and change things. So I can't speak to what the Court of Appeals intent was. All I can do is go by their language. And it seems to me that they go out of their way to separate non-occluding injuries from occluding injuries. And I'm not sure what they expect the lower courts to do with that. It may well be that the lower courts just have to make an adjustment in how they handle these things. And maybe the prosecutors take more care in charging people with multiple crimes or occlusion. And I don't know. I don't have the practical experience in criminal area about how.
Do you agree that with the potential issue that, aside from the statute of limitations issue, that a prosecutor could charge just differently?
In this case?
With a different descriptive averment, right?
No, I don't think they could. Not in this case.
You disagree with his statements about? Okay.
Now, one thing that's been mentioned here that I did not put in my brief, but it would become, it could become an issue at some point, is that when I first started looking at, and let me finish this thought if you would for just a minute or so, is that it appeared to me that the greater and lesser offenses were exactly the same with the omission of the word impeding. Yet the lesser offense included the statutory ways and means of committing occlusion and even permitted the jury to find that appellant blocked the plaintiff's airway. And if, and this will be my concluding remark, if assault bodily family injury is just a simple assault, a lesser included, it's the same injury without aggravating elements that felony occlusion has, then in my mind, it's very much like an aggravated rape situation, is if is rape with elevating factors. And if the jury acquits a defendant on aggravated rape, that precludes a conviction on rape because that lesser included offense was included within the greater for which the defendant was acquitted. So, yeah, there's I see double jeopardy issues, but at least for right now, for purposes of this hearing in Ortiz, I don't know how we address it, other than the fact that this court take Ortiz literally until it's overruled or changed.
Justice Baker, Justice Kelly, any additional questions from Mr. McCall?
None here.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. With that, the cause will be once again submitted. I guess it still is submitted. And this court will stand in recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Justice.